It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimeras Comics. Chimeras is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimeras Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Thank you, this is Caffeinated Comics. I'm your host, John Clark. Merry Christmas, everybody! It is Christmas 2014! And in terms of this show, Christmas always means a new Doctor Who special. This is the first Christmas special that Peter Capaldi has done as the 12th Doctor, and it's an interesting story. It's a little deeper and a little weirder than we've had the last few years. So the morning after Christmas, Bill Monroe called me and said he wanted to talk about it. Now, this conversation was the only time Bill and I talked over the holidays, so we kind of get into everything. So what you have is kind of our wrap-up holiday special for 2014 with Bill Monroe. Let's talk to him.
Well, first of all, Merry Christmas, Bill.
Yeah, Merry Christmas, John, and happy Boxing Day to you.
Oh yeah, it is Boxing Day right now, so we should fight.
We should fight, you know. or you know, really my biggest boxing memory is it's just all about Mr. T.
See, for me it's all about Mike Tyson eating Evander Holyfield. Or at least a small portion of him.
Or at least a small portion of him. You know, it's you know, and that's what it is. It's either cannibalism or it's going back to the movies. And that's really what sports comes down to for us, isn't it?
Yeah, so if you see a zombie movie, that you're done.
Then we're done. That's it. Boxing Day foretells the advance of the zombie apocalypse.
There you go.
You know, we're always wondering exactly when The Walking Dead began. It was December 26th.
Yeah, Boxing Day. There you go. I mean, it was in Atlanta, so it was hot anyway.
Exactly.
So, yeah, for me, Boxing Day is all about opening your DVD sets and binge watching. And this year, I didn't get too much that I haven't seen. My dad sent me the complete Sergeant Bilko.
Okay.
Which I'm appreciative of. Yeah, but the first episode I put on, I was like, oh, I saw this on MeTV. And I tried another one, I was like, oh, I saw this on MeTV. So I haven't watched it. I'm still going through the last season of Next Generation. On Blu-ray, which I am reminded of, besides the final episode, is pretty bad. And then I got, my in-laws got me Birds of Prey, the complete series.
Birds of Prey.
Do you remember this?
Series. That was that, wait, is that that movie that we watched?
No, it was a TV show on the WB. It was right after Smallville. They were trying to do another Smallville, and obviously they couldn't figure that out until now when they're doing Arrow and Flash. But this was the Birds of Prey is a book set in Gotham, which is Oracle, who's Batgirl in a wheelchair.
Right.
In the book, it was Black Canary and Huntress. And in this one, Huntress, there was a Huntress, but she was like the daughter of Batman and Catwoman. And it was supposedly the Batman from the Tim Burton universe who the Joker killed Catwoman, so he ran away. And because
gotcha.
Of
– you know, I vaguely remember this being advertised. It's rattling around in the back of my head. And for some reason, I had the good sense not to watch it.
It's very, very bad. I rented it on Netflix, and during Batman's 75th anniversary, I just threw it on my wish list because I looked at my shelf and I was like, what televised Batman do I not own? And that was the only thing that came up.
Right, exactly. At this point, you would really have to pick up. The only thing missing is, like, you know, Batman hosting The Price is Right for a week.
Oh, yeah. I do have Legends of the Superheroes on DVD now, which is the one with Ghetto Man.
Right.
I own that.
Right.
Because Adam West plays Batman in it.
Nice.
Yeah, now, but
did you catch the Nerdist a couple weeks ago when they had Adam West on?
Yeah, Adam West made the rounds. I also caught him on Gilbert Gottfried's podcast.
Which, okay, yeah. Gilbert, I mean, it was really interesting. It's, you know, it seems like he's doing a Shatner only like 20 years later, where it seems like about 20 years or so ago, maybe 20 1985 now is really when Shatner decided, you know what, I'm just going to embrace what I did as Kirk, you know, whether it's, you know, not only the movie cinematic, but also the camp of it, and just going to celebrate it. And it looks like finally Adam West is actually doing that in a way that he historically hasn't.
Yeah, I think with Shatner, it was famously when he hosted Saturday Night Live.
Right, that was where it started to turn.
Yeah, and that's the famous Get a Life sketch. But people forget, he was hosting Saturday Night Live because Star Trek IV was such a big hit, and T.J. Hooker was on the air, so he was already doing very well. He wasn't trying to stage a comeback by doing this. But he saw, you know, he saw an opportunity and ran with it. With Adam West, it's like 10 years after he's been on Family Guy. Well, also, Adam West has been really campaigning with the 66 Blu-ray sets out.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's definitely that element to plug and actually move through and drive that business. But yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to hear that and to see that. And I wonder if that's also just an element of, you know, just, you know, sort of growing up and maturing, and just, you know, you come to a point where you just accept, you know, this is what my life is, and I can be proud of that. And it made people happy.
Yeah, and you know what? I think more to the point, what's surprising me right now is Michael Keaton starting to do that about Batman. I mean, you have Birdman out, which I've been meaning to get to forever, and I've heard mixed things, but I've heard it's pretty interesting. But like since this year, since like RoboCop and Birdman, in press conferences, he's just telling stories about Batman, which he never did.
Right. Now, he never seemed to run away from his Batman time,
but he kind of tried to ignore it, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it sort of got lumped in. You know, Michael Keaton has one of those interesting careers where you just think of him as just sort of that ordinary guy. You see him in a lot of rom-coms, but then you look back at what he's done, and, you know, with Batman, and he was Beetlejuice, right?
Yep, he's Beetlejuice. They're still talking about a sequel.
I mean, you start putting together that just really wacky, zany stuff, and when you think of wacky, out there, fantasy, you know, type of actors, Michael Keaton just doesn't come to mind. He's a great, you know, Bruce Wayne in that respect. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of in some respects, sort of, you know, he's got that class, he's got that subtle thing, you know, and, you know, just sort of that ordinary, quiet guy, rich guy, successful guy, guy who gets a lot of respect, but you don't expect him to be the guy who's going to be running out, putting on wacky costumes, running around the city.
Right. And I think Michael Keaton's attitude reminds me a lot of like Norm Macdonald, who's somebody who's really talented, very well loved, but when he does something that becomes a little too popular, he kind of just walks away from it.
Okay, I I've never really noticed that about Norm Macdonald. I've never really seen Norm Macdonald become really, really popular.
Well, the thing is, he was really popular on SNL and then got fired, and then
he wasn't popular on SNL.
He was immensely popular on Weekend Update and doing Bob Dole. He was, and Burt Reynolds on Jeopardy. He was the guy before Will Ferrell really came into his own.
Oh, come on,
he's the guy of the mid-90s.
I will tell you that Norm Macdonald was brilliant on Weekend Update, and he was hated. Ordinary people hated Norm Macdonald on Weekend Update.
But they loved him doing Burt Reynolds and Bob Dole. And NBC, it was NBC Brass that hated him on Weekend Update.
He was never the general, he never had the general, outside of the comedy world, ordinary people never gravitated toward Norm Macdonald in the way they did, you know, would do a Will Ferrell or an Adam Savage or even a Chris Kattan. Norm Macdonald was brilliant.
Norm Macdonald was more popular than Chris Kattan.
Oh, Chris Kattan was way more popular than Norm.
No, Norm has done more after Saturday Night Live. He had this sitcom that ran for like 3 seasons. He had a few movies. He's had a few shows since. And his stand-up career has done really well. Chris Kattan is kind of hard to find.
but he's more known to more people.
I don't know. I think you're arguing.
I think you're in a comedy bubble here.
Maybe.
And Norm Macdonald is brilliant. I mean, no question.
Have you seen?
And he's funny and he's hysterical. But most people have no idea who he is.
Well, now I think, but that moment when he was doing Weekend Update,
he was the guy for a while.
Saturday Night Live always has one guy.
McDonald on Weekend Update, they were talking about, when is SNL going to replace this guy?
No, you're totally wrong.
No,
you're totally wrong. Because they replaced him with Colin Quinn, and Colin Quinn's like first monologue was like, yeah, I know I'm not Norm, and I know it sucks that they fired him off this this thing and let's just try to do this. You know, it's not like NBC did not go, you know what, Colin Quinn is better than Norm MacDonald. No one has ever, I love Colin Quinn, no one's ever said that.
You know, if you ask most people what they know about Norm MacDonald, if they know him, they might know him for assistant crack whore. That's it.
And that was a joke on Weekend Update.
That was a joke on Weekend Update. And that was his zenith in pop culture.
Yeah, his zenith in pop culture.
And he deserved more. But it never went bigger than that.
But and that's my point about Michael Keaton until we got into this argument, was that he was this guy where, like, he was in the center. And, you know, he had two or three different sitcoms. But he was in the center of the zeitgeist for the moment and then just kind of went, meh. And that's, right. And that's what
right.
Michael
he went
Keaton
ahead,
did.
He'd had enough.
Yeah, and yeah, Michael Keaton has been saying lately that after Tim Burton left, which he was amicably fired from the third Batman movie, the story... The story
that was a good idea.
Yeah, the story Tim Burton tells was he went in for a meeting for the third Batman movie, and all the executives were like, hey, don't you want to do some more personal stuff? Don't you want to do that Nightmare Before Christmas or that movie about Ed Wood or something? And Tim Burton's like, you guys don't want me to make another one. No, you can make another one. And then Michael Keaton has been saying lately that they gave him the third script. They gave him Batman Forever, and he went,
uh-huh.
And Michael Keaton said himself, he went, yeah, this is crap. I quit.
Well, thank God they got Tim Burton out of the way so they could go ahead and make that Batman and Robin film. Because that never would have gotten made if Tim Burton had stayed at the helm.
No. But, you know, with hindsight, I mean, if you start playing alternate reality – if we didn't have Batman and Robin, would we have gotten the Christopher Nolan Batmans? Or would they have just kept churning out Tim Burton-type Batman movies?
I would be
like
okay
like James
with
Bond.
That.
Really? You'd be okay in a world with no Dark Knight?
I'd be with more Tim Burton, and if we could have gone for – and if we could trade that for no Batman and Robin but more Tim Burton, as brilliant as those first movies were, yeah, I'd take that.
Although we have something like 20 different Tim Burton movies.
We do.
And arguably,
you know, the negative trade off. You know, if he hadn't gotten to make Nightmare Before Christmas, Nightmare Before Christmas is brilliant.
Yes,
you know,
it is.
You know what? I'll take the way things played out. Isn't this how these things always go? I won't pull at that thread of the tapestry, because. Since he did get fired and they did go ahead and make Batman and Robin, that's why we got Nightmare Before Christmas plus the Christopher Nolan. You pair Christopher Nolan Batman movies with Nightmare Before Christmas and you've got a winning deal.
I would say that you'd throw Ed Wood in there, which I think is his masterpiece. That's a absolute brilliant film. I think Burton is one of those directors where he started at his peak and everything from Pee-wee to Ed Wood is just pure genius.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's Mars Attacks, and he starts getting really shaky.
Wait, you know, I've only seen Ed Wood once, and I can – it's one of those movies that didn't quite grab me in the same way, but I can see it. It's definitely a high-quality piece, and total respect for him for making that.
Yeah, I watch it every Halloween. That's one of my go-to movies. But we were not supposed to have a Batman Tim Burton discussion. Oh, did you get anything good for Christmas?
I got lots of great stuff.
What'd
Christmas.
You get?
I've got some books. I got a new Haruki Murakami book. I've got the latest William Gibson book. Neat sweaters. Some other neat stuff like that.
I love you got neat sweaters.
I had neat sweaters. Hey, you know what? Since I now actually, you know, the big thing for me this year was I changed jobs and, after the summer I stopped working from home and now I have to commute into the office. Yeah. But that meant I needed, you know, you can't, well, technically according to our dress code, I could just wear, you know, sweatpants and fleece to the office every day. But, you know, I don't want to do that. So I actually needed to, you know, like some nice sweaters. And, you know, I guess that means I'm getting older. You know, that sweater, that's kind of nice.
Yeah. I did the same thing. I switched jobs as well. And I was already commuting, but I tripled my commute. And I found that, like, just my podcasting subscriptions took a huge leap forward.
You know, I'm actually getting through some more of my podcasts. I'm getting down to like the third and fourth on the subscription list now, and and actually getting through all of them and adding some more. So that's definitely been one of the perks of the commute. But I'd still rather have that 2.5 hours of my day back.
Yeah. Are you listening to Serial? Are you, like, into Serial like everyone's supposed to be?
I never got into Serial.
I listened to the first episode, and I thought it was well done, but I didn't quite get what everybody was going crazy about.
You know, I think it's their first exposure. You know, but you know, if I'm going to add another podcast to my list, it really has to be – I really have to have a damn good reason to do that. I did just add Startup to my list.
That? I don't know.
That is by Alex Bloomberg. A lot of people are putting it, you know, in the same category as Serial. But what it is, he used to be on Planet Money, the NPR show Planet Money, which – another great podcast about just understanding all the complex world of finances and business and what's really going on, and they really explain it in a way that just makes sense to people. But what Startup is he left Planet Money, and now he is starting his own podcasting company to actually do storytelling, This American Life type journalism, and this podcast Startup is following him through that whole process, from his initial conversations with venture capitalists to try and get funding, to trying to name the company, to negotiating an equity split with partners and investors, and and it's really telling the story of a guy who's doesn't know anything about, you know, the startup culture that we have, really, from a practical standpoint, and actually going through that and taking it step by step by step. And it's really fascinating to watch that happen as he learns more about negotiating the world of bringing investors on board, runway cash so that you can actually hire people and go out and do these types of things. How are you going to build, you know, build a large company based on this technology and this type of thing. And it's really fascinating from that storytelling perspective. And the episodes are only like, you know, 20, 30 minutes a piece. So it goes pretty quick.
Wow, you don't find too many podcasts under an hour. I mean, even we're an hour.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's interesting. There's a lot of the commentary ones are tend to go about an hour. A lot of the more focused ones tends to be a lot shorter. For example, another couple that I listen to the Manager Tools and the Career Tools podcasts a lot, and they're typically in that 20 to 30 minutes. And usually what you see happen is when you've got a podcast that is going to be, you know, we're going to deliver this focused piece of information, that's where they tend to start being a little bit shorter, start from a more educational standpoint as opposed to a news or a commentary type of podcast. Radiolab does an interesting split. If you're not listening to Radiolab, you know, I highly recommend it. Just beautiful. I mean, really, you're talking about folks who just embrace what you can do with audio and sound and still tell fascinating stories. But their hour-long episodes are just rebroadcast from their NPR show. But they also do these Radiolab shorts where they'll just take a shorter story and tell it in 15 minutes. And it really is, you know, it's about the audio poetry and really, you know, telling some fascinating things about that, and including science and sound and storytelling. To really look at, you know, how these things interact, what we feel versus, you know, what does the science say, and how does this all work together? It was a fascinating episode, a couple years ago about a 15-minute episode about Bolero, the musical piece, and about how that ties into what happens with people's minds as they start to lose their mind. Really fascinating, amazing stuff.
Hmm. Yeah, I. Been listening. I've been going almost the entire other way. I've been listening a lot to Gilbert Gottfried's podcast.
And that's the difference between you and I.
Yeah, that's why we bring different perspectives to this show.
Gilbert Gottfried and you know, as I've said before, Gilbert Gottfried makes my soul want to eat itself.
I can see that, but the thing I love about it is he was on the Nerdist a few weeks ago, as I brought up, and he mentioned his, so I started listening to his, and all he does is cover old Hollywood stories. So right. He has like biographers of the Three Stooges, or Mickey Dolenz, or Adam West, or Larry Storch, or Henry Winkler. And he's like, they tell all these like great old stories about like Abbott and Costello, or like how Happy Days was started. And whenever Gilbert goes off the rails, which is often, He's got a co-host who is literally there to keep things on track. Because they'll be telling a story, and Gilbert will just be like, "And then I heard that he was an alcoholic, and Jerry Lewis used to poop on the coffee table and get a girl under the coffee table." And then the other guy comes in, he's like, "So Adam, you went to make movies after Batman."
You know, maybe I can handle the Gilbert Gottfried podcast as a transcript.
Maybe. I would suggest going through, finding the one guest you really want to hear, and then seeing if you can take it. I'm a huge Gilbert fan. We saw him at Caroline's years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of the one I've been looking forward to. As, of course, the regular ones that I always listen to, like Mark Maron and John Suntress and The Nerdist and Mission Log, I still love. Mission Log is wrapping up the first season of Next Generation now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so they've been on for, I think, 2 years, and they just go every week. They did the whole animated series,
mm-hmm.
and they did – I believe they did all of the – yeah, they did all of the original series movies. So they did 1 to 6 and then jumped over to Next Gen, and they're going to do all Next Gen, then those movies, then do Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Enterprise, and J.J. Abrams.
And what's interesting is that despite – all of that content they still have to get to. That's a podcast that is, you know, both finite in nature and is not time sensitive.
Right. And they've said – they talk a lot about like, oh, whenever you're listening to this and they have said many times in the air it's going to take them 13 years to cover everything.
Right.
So they're in it for the long haul. But I find both of them, John Ray and Ken Champion, to be or is it Ken Ray and John Champion? They're really entertaining, and they just have a lot of fun with each other. And I listen to that one in the car more than I listen to a lot of them. I'll listen to at work, and I'll just have that on instead of music in my headphones. I like to listen to them in the car for some reason because I feel like they have such a nice energy back and forth that I'll find myself talking to both of them.
Okay.
And I mentioned –
and that's something better to do in the car than to do in the office.
Yeah, and I've mentioned them on the show, and I've tweeted them, and they've retweeted us. But they're like two guys I would love, love, love to talk to.
Okay.
Because they just have a very warm energy. They're very smart, and they mm-hmm. look really deeply into Star Trek. And, you know, for people that care, which is you and I.
Right.
And I also love to not watch the episode first.
I was going to say, and probably most of the people who are listening here care on some level about Star Trek.
Yeah, some of them. Although, as we've seen, there's a generational drift. I think like Steven and David and those guys, they don't know too much about Star Trek because they didn't grow up. I think if you didn't grow up with Next Generation, you weren't really a Star Trek person because you either grew up with the original series like we did or
– right.
More to the point.
Or syndication, yeah.
Yeah, we grew up with syndication and the movies. I think I got into it because of the movies and mm-hmm. because of Star Wars, and it was the only space show on TV. But also, you know, motion picture came out. You know, we were 8 or 9, and I was 10 when Wrath of Khan came out, so it's still pretty impressionable.
Right.
And then I found, like, people about 10 years younger than us really grew up with Next Gen. But then people younger than that, you know, Voyager – and Enterprise didn't have the saturation that Next Gen did.
Okay. And I guess there were more alternatives too, because by that point you started to have, you know, Babylon 5 and mm-hmm. Stargate and right. siphoning off some of the sci-fi audience.
Yeah, and let's not forget the X-Files was the biggest thing in the 90s.
Right.
Yeah. And that show still really holds up. We watched a Christmas episode on Christmas Eve. But speaking of sci-fi shows that everyone's involved with...
Yes.
We. This was what we were going to talk about 25 minutes ago.
Funny how that works.
Yeah. We both watched the Doctor Who Christmas special last night.
We did. It was actually the first time I actually watched it while it was actually airing.
Oh, really? You didn't see it last year?
No, last year, you know, for various reasons, I ended up watching it like 3 days later on my, you know, I bought it through Google Play and watched it on the plane on a flight back to Seattle.
Okay.
And, you know, that's kind of a powerful thing. You know, it's interesting to actually watch last year's on an airplane when all of a sudden you're sitting there in the back end coach and you've got these space battles flying on and you've got this, you know, in this really emotional episode and you're just sitting there in coach just clutching your tablet watching what's going to happen.
Yeah,
and then Amy shows up and,
Yeah, and then and then he regenerates into Capaldi. I can imagine, like, watching that in a public place is like – You're just trying to restrain every reaction that you have.
Exactly.
But what? So what did you think of last night's?
You know, I thought it was. I liked it. I thought it was a really solid Christmas episode. I think there's a lot of stuff going on with this episode. First of all, let me get this out of the way because you know obviously we're talking about spoilers. That's kind of a given with this podcast. But one of the things that I think they could do, I don't think they're going to because it would just anger everybody. But towards the very end, when the doctor pulls the thing, gets the thing off of his face, and we see him laying on those rocks, you know what that scene looks just like?
Trenzalore?
No, not Trenzalore. Oh, Trenzalore is another possibility.
Because I said that out loud when we were watching it.
Oh,
it looked like when Clara jumped into the timeline,
uh-huh,
and found the 11th Doctor at the end, those red rocks, it looked a lot like that.
You know what it looked like to me? It looked like the scene where from earlier this season where Clara is dreaming because the doctor put the sleep dot on her neck. And you know, when she takes him out to a in her dream world, she takes him out to the volcano and starts throwing TARDIS keys away.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like, which means this entire season from that episode on could just be Clara dreaming.
Yeah, and that was the end of the season, so that's not even that much. Well, the other thing I thought is they never entirely proved that the end of the episode wasn't still a dream.
Exactly. And I think all that gets tied up in the whole idea that you know this was just a whole rewritten at the last minute when they decided they were going to bring Clara back for more episodes.
Yeah,
this is supposed to be her final episode.
And that's the interesting thing that I wanted to bring up because they didn't announce that she was coming back. They sent a press conference out after the episode aired. I saw it on my Facebook this morning. So whether it was a Moffat, let's lie to the public so we don't have spoilers in the episode, which we know he's been known to do.
Right.
Or was it really that close to the wire where it's like, let's reshoot this final scene? Because either way, it worked. Because when they showed her in her 80s, which happens at the end, I was like, oh, okay, this is an interesting send-off the same way that kind of with Amy and Rory.
Well, that plus at the very same time, everything that's happening in that – almost everything that's happening in that episode with her and the doctor, it mirrors what she was doing with the Christmas crackers with Eleven at the end of his episode.
Yeah.
Where they bring out to open the Christmas cracker and you know she has to hold on to Eleven's hand because he's so old and weak. And now we see Capaldi
doing
the exact same thing.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
And so that was elegantly done. But you know, with that in mind, even let's say that was the end of it, and this was going to be here's the problem. I have some problems with Clara, and I think Clara's gotten the really short shrift. I think her very last episode should have been Trenzalore, where she split herself all across the Doctor's timeline. That would have wrapped up her arc completely and cleanly. But there was nothing in this episode, even if you're going to give her a send-off, whether that's going to be her, you know, just choosing not to wake up as she leans on Santa, or if it's going to be, you know, the 80-year-old and the Doctor just never came back, you know, that's not satisfying, whatever. But they never really close out the Impossible Girl story. They just essentially, you know, with her splitting across his timeline, great, that would have closed out Impossible Girl, explained her, maybe she never really existed, maybe she existed at one point, spread across the – great, I get that. But now they've brought her back as a character and actually as a person, but they haven't really talked about how that relates to, you know, to Oswin and to, you know, Clara in Victorian times and all that. And they haven't told us how the modern Clara and the current Clara is part of that. And maybe they just want to leave the Impossible Girl story with Matt Smith, but until they actually – but it's really frustrating that they're not actually giving us that and telling us that.
Yeah, I agree. I think when her character was created for that mystery, and that was my problem with her in that season, was that she wasn't really a character. She was a plot point.
Yeah, she was. She was never a companion for Matt Smith. She was a project for Matt Smith.
Right. And then you could see production-wise, they wanted to keep her, because the tradition of Doctor Who, which makes sense, is when you change the Doctor, you leave the companion, so the audience has someone they already identify with. The only time I've really seen that broken is with Amy Pond. And a lot of that is Stephen Moffat coming in and wiping the slate clean of the Russell T. Davies era.
Right.
But usually, I mean, if you go back in the classic Doctors, it's always the Doctor regenerates and he's surrounded by the companions or they're nearby and they react to him regenerating the way the audience does. So that was the idea. And then it was this whole Danny Pink season, which was kind of more about Danny Pink than about Clara. And it was like – and then Clara was a nanny, but now she's not a nanny. Now she's a teacher. And it was like – it seemed like they just tried to create a new character for this season to fit this season.
Exactly, and they really didn't need to do that, and it really did not make sense to do that.
Yeah, and I was kind of looking forward to her send off, and I'd be like, "Well, she's always been kind of problematic because she was created for different reasons in mind than what you need right now."
Exactly,
you know, because as I said, you're given the old companion with the new doctor to have someone to identify with, but we never get to identify with Clara, and so her.
And at the very time, I understand what they're doing with making her reluctant to embrace Capaldi as the Doctor in the first couple of episodes. But at the same time, because of what happened at Trenzalore, because she's the one who got the Doctor to steal the TARDIS in the very beginning, because she has, you know, we see her, you know, in the background with, you know, with 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, you know, she has been a part of every incarnation of the Doctor, and she should know better than anybody else what is the nature of the Doctor, because she has been with the Doctor for 2,000 years, or I guess at that point, pre-Christmastown, 1,300 years, but still, so she should have that much more intimate connection with just what is the very nature of the Doctor overall.
Right, and since time is not linear in the Doctor Who universe, there was every reason to suspect, even though we didn't see it in the episode, that she would run into the 12th and maybe the 13th and 14th Doctor, because it seems like his regenerations are now infinite after Day of the Doctor. Like, well, she should have already seen the future incarnations.
They gave him just 12 more.
Yeah, I feel like it was intentionally vague.
Okay.
So I don't – I think, you know, they'll cross that bridge when they come to it.
Right.
You know, after 12 more actors quit
– Theoretically, we've got another 30, 40, 50 years before we
if each guy usually stays like 4 or 5 years. It's interesting because when we were talking about Michael Keaton, I was thinking how
– Is Michael Keaton going to be the next Doctor?
Yes. I would love to see that.
That would be awesome. He would make a great Doctor.
But I was thinking about how Michael Keaton being so open about his time being Batman, I think my theory about it was that I think he's comfortable now that he's seen Christian Bale take up the mantle and have a huge hit, and then he moves on. And I feel like that he's not worried about typecasting the way that Christopher Reeve had to deal with it.
Right.
And I think he's feeling like, well, really, being Batman is a lot like being James Bond. You take on this huge role. It puts you on this global scale. You do 3 or 4 of them, you quit, and then somebody else becomes it. And that's not what Adam West thought, because there was, you know, the two guys who played Batman in the serials, nobody remembers those. Adam West thought he was Batman.
Right.
But I think now people see Batman as James Bond, of like, okay, you know, Ben Affleck's going to be Batman, and people are already saying, who's going to be Batman after Ben Affleck? He hasn't done one movie yet, and we're already talking about who's next. And I think that
So what you're saying is that Michael Keaton and Pierce Brosnan really just need to take Christopher Eccleston out to lunch and have a long talk with him.
Oh, yeah. There you go. The two of them. They're like, look, people love us and we made terrible movies. Although, no, the Tim Burton movies are not nearly as bad as the Schumacher movies.
The Tim Burton movies are good.
But I think, there is – we've gotten to this comfort level of reboots where we don't worry so much about typecasting. It's like David Tennant now is – he's like the emissary of Doctor Who. In every interview he's in, he talks about Doctor Who.
Right, right. You know, I caught him on Ferguson in the wrap up, and he's like, and you know, he's embracing it to the point of, you know, pulling up the TARDIS off of Craig's desk and going, "Whose TARDIS is this?" And he's like, "Oh, it's Matt's."
Yeah, Yeah, exactly, because he's someone that's had – he's had a great career outside of Doctor Who, still not known in this country.
Right.
And there's a clip – I put it on the Facebook page. There's a clip of him explaining what Doctor Who is to David Letterman. And Dave's like, "So you're like a president?" He's like, "So somebody's out there now being a Doctor Who?" And I think we have that feeling about that and the companions, and it's like, and I do feel that like pulling Clara this way and that has diluted what Capaldi's doctor is going to be, because we haven't gotten to focus on him enough. And when I thought she was leaving, I was like, great, who's going to be the next companion? What kind of personality are they going to be? What are they going to show us about the doctor?
And I think they did a nice job of trying out some different companions so far in the first half of this series. That student, the more delinquent of the students, who stumbled into the TARDIS and who he took to took on that ride, I thought she would make a really interesting companion. And I think when you go to the older doctor, like Capaldi is now, it becomes much easier. With a doctor of Capaldi's age, it's much less creepy to put a high school girl as the companion than it would have been, say, if Matt Smith had still been the doctor.
Right, because he's middle-aged, there's less sexual tension.
Exactly.
Although they did do that. You remember that Neil Gaiman Cyberman episode where when Clara was still a nanny, that those two kids went on the TARDIS. And I was like, well, is this the new norm? And then they were like, that was that one episode. Or the one where the planet is overgrown with trees and he takes the whole class onto the TARDIS.
Onto the TARDIS. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and that's not too unusual. I mean, he certainly had plenty of guests on the TARDIS in the past. But to actually, when they start defining them as more of a character, those kids from the class, none of them really, were built out as characters. That other girl, they did build her out as a character. We see her in the very first episode of this season, where she's the one challenging Clara in Clara's memory about how to deal with people questioning you. We see her, and then we see her coming recurring in a couple of episodes. I think she would have made a really interesting companion and a real interesting direction to take the show.
Yeah, and I mean, and they played with Danny Pink as well. I remember Danny Pink was announced as being the other companion.
Right.
Whereas really he was much more of a supporting character.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's interesting, because you can have when you see people who actually step up to the companion level, even with relatively little screen time, like Rory's dad. He appears in the TARDIS only in one episode.
Yeah, and I think he's only in two episodes, isn't he?
Yeah, but then he travels with the Doctor off screen.
Yeah.
Extensively, and actually becomes a companion.
Right, and you had that with Donna Noble's father, who appears in the final episode of.
Right, exactly. of all the people that's going to actually foretell the Doctor's death.
Yeah, and although like I'm not one of those people that's against Clara, or I do find she's been inconsistent. I'm okay with another season with her, but I thought she wasn't going to be in the Christmas special. And I thought when they were talking about negotiating, I was like, well, she's not in the Christmas special. Maybe she'll come back. And I thought, oh, it would be really interesting to see a Capaldi episode without Clara. And that's kind of what I wanted to see, a new companion, because I find his doctor so interesting. But he just seems to be hemmed in by the rest of the show.
Right. He gets his very doctoring moments, like when he takes the reins on the sleigh. It's one of the few times you get to see him actually having fun. But he has got such great lines, and it was really interesting in this last episode, in this Christmas special too, to see them actually give a bunch of his lines to Santa when they're all standing around. They're about to go through the manuals, and Santa starts spouting off the science stuff, and Capaldi's like, no, that's my deal.
I also loved it. It was a very obvious joke when he says, "How do all the presents fit on your sleigh?"
It's bigger on the inside.
Yeah. What did you think of Nick Frost as Santa?
I thought he did a really good job. I thought that was a good role. It was a good way of playing up the Santa. He walked in with such an ease and confidence in that role. you know, as you would expect from Santa, and just being comfortable. So, you know, yeah, how do the course reindeer don't fly? That makes no sense. Well, how do they do? Magic carrots. Okay. I'm there with you on the magic carrots. You know, three little words, My Little Pony. You know, it's just the right amount of edge with joy, with just pure confidence. And that's the thing about Capaldi's Doctor. I don't think that this is not a comment on Capaldi playing the Doctor. I think this is just the nature of 12, is that he is always just so tense and on edge and always just feels like everything's about to collapse around him, which granted he almost always is with the Doctor. But, you know, with Capaldi, you actually see that and just see that slightly overwhelmed about everything.
Yeah. Yeah, I was very impressed with Nick Frost because I thought it was actually the best performance that he's given in his career so far. Not that I've seen everything, but he's known as being kind of the clown next to Simon Pegg. You know, in Shaun of the Dead or in Hot Fuzz. Right. In World's End, which I loved and nobody noticed last year. He's a little more of the straight man to Simon Pegg, but he's always been kind of the other half, and I know he's had his own shows. This was the first time I really saw him playing a character and not his persona.
Okay, yeah.
And I was very – like when I heard Nick Frost as Santa Claus, I was like, okay, it's going to be big and broad and comedic. But he's kind of – he can be very serious.
Yeah, well, you know, and that's the thing. You don't have to play that role big because you're Santa. You're just going to be inherently big.
Yeah. Yeah, just, you know, the costume alone.
That spot of red in that gray world.
And how bright is that red? It's not like – it's not a burgundy.
No, that is, it's that, like, that is full-on Coca-Cola red.
Yeah, it almost looked digitally graded. I also really liked how they called out the alien homage.
Right.
Because immediately everybody's thinking, well, that's a facehugger. And I love – not only did they address it, but then they slapped it down so well.
Exactly.
The one guy's like, well, those are like facehuggers. And Doctor's like, what's a facehugger? You know, that horror movie Alien. You made a horror movie called Alien? No wonder you're always being invaded.
That's offensive. Exactly. So one of the other things I've been trying to figure out about this story, and that I would have liked a little more information, if we got these random people who get attacked by these things. And it's like, okay, we don't see the connection. It's real interesting to see, you know, the one recovering from the breakout, watching the movie marathon, the woman who's actually in the wheelchair. That was really kind of cool. But I want to know, how did these people stumble across them? And Clara, and, you know, as one of them, what is it that brought these people together? Because it seemed like it would make more, you know, to me, as I was going through it, I'm like, okay, so maybe this is an invasion that's impacted most of the world. But it's not. It's just these people from various parts.
Well, it seemed like what they were saying was that these people were connected, and I thought they were like a cell of a greater invasion. But but when these people defeat them, that's the end of it. And I was like, well, isn't this still attacking the world? Doesn't the Doctor need to save the world? And the one character who apparently dies, you never see him ever again.
Right.
Like the one who gets sucked through the video screen.
Yeah.
They never come back to him. You don't see him as a corpse. You don't see him as anything else. And so on the one hand, I am led to believe that it's only those six people.
We can't even
people.
Assume he was real.
Well, that could be it. So it could just be, you know, the five of them.
Mm-hmm.
And when each one of them broke their hold, you know, those crabs died, and that was the end of the invasion, which would make more sense because I'm like, the Doctor just doesn't seem to care if there's any other ones out there.
Right, exactly. Or is it possible there was only ever just one?
The one on Clara?
On either Clara or on the Doctor.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what do we know about the Doctor so far? So far, we know that A, the Doctor lies,
yeah.
And the other thing we learn here that the Doctor tells us, B, is that there is no way to know you're ever not dreaming.
Yeah, exactly.
Did Moffat just throw in just a whole bunch? Let me just It's like when you save before you go into a battle in a video game. Is this just a save point for Moffat so he can always reboot right back to this dream segment and say, ooh, yeah, those six episodes did not go well. Reboot.
Maybe.
Moffat wouldn't do that to us, would he?
Yes, Moffat always does that to us. Yes, some people, that's all he ever does. Even Sherlock is starting to do crazy stuff like that. Yeah, I thought there were some things that were open-ended, although this did feel like a Christmas special that stands alone, because all we have at the end is the Doctor and Clara will return in season 8. We didn't get a trailer, so nothing's been shot. We also don't know when it's coming back. Is it summer? Is it fall? We don't know.
My understanding is that it's fall.
Okay, so we're not going to see anything for a while.
We're not going to see anything for a while, no.
Yeah, I also like the Doctor's look in this episode, that he just wore a hoodie under his jacket. It seems like they landed on the jacket, and then right. The shirt they never quite figured out. Sometimes it was white, sometimes it was black with like spots. This time it was a hoodie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
you know, in the Orient Express, he's got the bow tie.
Yeah, you know, they would
tweak. And that's where he also has the jelly babies too, which is nice.
Yeah, that is nice. And with the other Doctors, they would tweak like the color of the shirt, or Tennant wore a couple of different pairs of Converse, and
right.
Matt Smith had different colors of bow ties and shirts, but their look was kind of locked down. I feel like Capaldi's, they went minimalist, but they're realizing it's not popping. So they're still
trying to figure it out. See, I don't think they went minimalist, because if you look back at what they were calling out to, I mean, that was very clearly – his outfit is very clearly a callback to number 3, which is, you know, the fancy, frilly type of thing. And I think it'll feel like, you know, that's certainly not minimalist.
Yeah, but Eccleston
was minimalist.
Yeah,
but you know, I think even in this episode, they just keep referring to him as the magician.
Yeah, but it's that sleek black, not a lot of detail. Originally, the shirt was a stark white button collar with no tie.
Right.
It's almost just a suit with no tie. I feel like it's very understated compared to Matt Smith or obviously Tom Baker or Sylvester McCoy.
Well, sure, but I mean, as compared to Eccleston.
I feel like it's as understated as Eccleston, but Eccleston was more rumpled with a leather jacket. Whereas Capaldi is a suit with Doc Martens, because the shoes always have a little. The shoes always say "run" with the Doctor. You know,
that I can see that in the brief for the costume department. The shoes must always say "run."
Well, at the very least, the actor is going to run every single episode.
Was it did Donahue comment on that there's actually a surprising amount of running?
Yeah. Well, you know, the Doctor doesn't fight very much. He outsmarts. Like,
right.
He doesn't stand his ground and punch the alien in the face. That's what Kirk does.
I think Peter Davison kind of did some more of that stuff. I remember I was watching one of the caught one of those reruns with Peter Davison's Doctor, and all of a sudden, you know, the most un-Doctor thing I've ever seen. I mean, granted, the Doctor hates guns, never uses guns. Well, unless the gun happens to be canine, in which case Tom Baker used that gun all the time.
Yeah, just told him to kill everything.
just go, canine, shoot it. The Doctor never held a gun. Until we get to Peter Davison, who's just running around with automatic weapons.
Yeah.
Shotguns and stuff. It was just crazy.
Well, it's kind of like that's the 80s. Davison is the 80s. And how much did we like guns in the 80s? I mean, G.I. Joe alone.
Peter Davison is the G.I. Joe of Doctor Who.
Well, look at his years. They're both like 1984.
That's true.
My favorite thing about guns in science fiction was, in the 90s it got to ludicrous levels because of Schwarzenegger and Stallone.
Right.
But there is a period of the Hulk.
Well, and you see Weird Al hitting on that too in UHF.
Yeah, well, he's doing a direct parody of Rambo.
Right, exactly. Just piles of shell casings.
But there was a period in the 90s where the Hulk was running around with a gun.
What? how does the Hulk's finger fit through a trigger guard?
He had a giant Hulk-sized gun.
Oh, jeez. Was that Ang Lee's inspiration?
no, more like Jim Lee. Yeah, so, well, where do you think this leaves us for the next season? Is it, this is 9 we're going into, right?
I don't know if they're going to call it 9 or if it's going to be the back half of 8 or who knows.
Yeah, but, I mean, we kept the season numberings with Capaldi because the Blu-rays are out now and they say season 8.
Right.
So, right. But what do you think? Like I said, we're kind of just left at the end of this. What do you think season 9 is going to be?
I think in this next batch they're gonna have to go back to Gallifrey. And if I'm going to guess at a total plot line, what I think is going to happen, I don't know if you and I have talked about this before, but you know, I think he's got to go through it, and you know, there's going to be more battles and more fights. He hasn't really had a ton with a big Dalek fight yet, and I think he's going to.
Well, he went in a Dalek.
He went in a Dalek, but I mean, yeah, I mean that wasn't. You know, over, but I wasn't really a big in the same way. I mean, Eccleston obviously encountered, you know, the Dalek and interacted with the Dalek when it was just thought that it was just the one left. But he still had his big Dalek fight at the end, and we haven't seen Capaldi's yet. I think it's ultimately going to have to come down to Gallifrey, and I don't know if Capaldi will ever get to see Gallifrey or if he'll die in some final final battle before they can start, you know, looking at bringing Gallifrey back. I don't know if it's going to be like a Moses was never able to actually reach the promised land. Can Capaldi actually reach Gallifrey, or does it have to be a next generation? I think they're going to have to. What I think they need to do is they really need to come back to this impossible girl thing and wrap it up, and let's just figure out what Clara is. And I don't think they're going to do that. I think they're just going to let her go through as a companion, learn a little bit more about the doctor, build that relationship a little bit better. But I don't think we're actually going to get the resolution to Clara that we need. Clara has really been done a disservice. I really feel bad for the character because she has been the writers have done her a disservice. It really feels that way. So I don't know what direction we can go with that. But we're going to have to see another companion. And I think it's gonna come out. I really have no idea where it's going to come. I think Capaldi, I really do want to learn more about him, and maybe he needs to wander along around alone more. Maybe they'll actually take us back, and we'll see more of the Doctor as a child, where we got that glimpse. And again, this, you know, we talk about the, you know, Clara being spread across the Doctor's entire timeline that we saw in Trenzalore. We saw that happen again in this season when she just goes back and is actually under the Doctor's bed and actually grabs him as a little child in the barn. I think you're gonna come back to that some way, and we're gonna figure out how that happens. The other thing is that they haven't told us is, you know, with Danny Pink. Oh no, here's what's gonna happen. Here's what's going to happen. Clara is pregnant because we know Danny Pink is now dead.
Right.
Or he's not coming back. Maybe they'll bring him back like they brought Rose back like 15 different times. Yeah. But we already know that Danny Pink has descendants that travel through space. We've met them.
Right. And we know
Clara's
that
latched on them before. And maybe they're in different timelines that don't exist now. But I think they're going to – I think Clara's going to be pregnant.
And we know in this that Clara never remarries, or at least that's what she believes in her dream, is that she's never going to find anyone else.
Right, exactly.
Because when we see her in her 80s, she says she's never remarried.
Right, right. And again, that's not necessarily Clara's dream. That's the Doctor's dream.
Yeah, but they're sharing the dream because they both knew it, because when he wakes her up, she needs to see a mirror.
Right,
so she knew she was old in that dream. It wasn't just his dream.
Right.
So that's also what she believes. Because she was comfortable with it.
Yes. And she was comfortable with it. And she went ahead and lived her life and traveled and learned to fly a plane and lived the life that Donna had always wanted before she met the Doctor.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think I'm really hoping we let Capaldi off the leash. I would like to see one or two Clara-less episodes where even if they're just separated, where they get separated in the beginning of the episode and rejoin each other at the end. I want to see him on his own. I want to see him off the leash, really.
Right.
And if we're not going to get new writers, And it's still my dream that someday Grant Morrison will write one. There's apparently there's a petition out there and he wants to. But we've had Neil Gaiman write two of them. I'm sure Alan Moore won't write one.
So when Capaldi goes off-leash, do you want to see him going off-leash and going really dark Doctor? Or do you want to see him going and actually become having a joyous Doctor episode?
I don't know. And that's what I want. I want to see the possibilities. I want to see him react to different types of characters and see how that affects him. Because we see him bouncing off of Clara and we see him just kind of glancing off the characters in the episodes. I would like to see him get to know someone else a little bit more so we can get to know him a little more. We know that he's good with children. I think that was one of my favorite episodes this season was with the kids in London because we got to see a different side of him. I want to see more sides to this Doctor. I know Capaldi's an actor, can do it.
Right.
I know he really cares about it, and some of the interviews I've seen with him and some of the messages he's given to kids, he's very invested in this. He's not somebody who's – he's not an Eccleston. He's not going to do a season and check out.
Right. He is committed. You know, you talk about that episode where he was great with the kids and where London becomes filled with trees. That episode where he became the janitor.
Yep. That was fun.
He did a great job with that.
Yeah, and I feel like with both Matt Smith and David Tennant, we got to see them with different kinds of companions. We got to see them alone. We got to see them in different situations. They weren't always in modern-day London. That's really what I want to see. I want to explore the possibilities of this new Doctor who's full of potential. And if Clara's going to be there, let's not change her character a third time. let's try to explore what we set in this last season – and give her a good send-off, and then let's try to get a completely different type of companion. And, you know, I want to see I do want to see Capaldi fight a bunch of Daleks. I want to see him save the universe. You know, I want to see him close a temporal rift. Apparently people didn't like the Robin Hood episode, but that was one of my favorite ones because you got to see him travel back in time and be confused and be angry because things that were happening didn't jibe with his notions. Loved seeing that.
We've spent a lot of time with Capaldi inside the TARDIS.
Yeah, we have.
Less time with him outside the TARDIS.
And we haven't even seen him explore the TARDIS. He's just in that console room looking at space.
Right, right.
You know, like Matt Smith went to the heart of the TARDIS at some point.
Exactly.
So, yeah, that's what I'm hoping for. I think we'll get it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I really like Capaldi, but I'm not as excited about Doctor Who as I was when Matt Smith was the Doctor. And it has nothing to do with him. And I always say how Andrew Garfield is the Pierce Brosnan of Spider-Man's, where he's perfect for the role and he's in movies that are so terrible that he's not going to be remembered as being any good.
Right.
I'm really worried that Capaldi might be that in modern Doctor Who. And obviously there's worse Doctors and worse episodes in the classic run.
Sure.
But I want him to really fulfill his potential. And a lot of people say that the only way to do that is to fire Moffat. I don't necessarily know that. I don't necessarily believe that. And we're not going to get that. So let's try to have the best season we can.
Agreed.
The greatest thing in the world.
This week.
Greatest thing in the world is Bone Shaker by Sherry Priest. This is it's a first time novel, and what it is, it's basically it's a cyberpunk zombie story set in about the 1880s in Seattle. It starts off with the idea that, you know, there was a big contest to drill for gold in the Yukon. The Russians were sponsoring it at the time, and some guy builds a machine that's supposed to drill. The machine goes crazy, drills through Seattle, and ends up unleashing this gas. This blight, which turns people who are infected into zombies, and is very difficult for survivors. They have to abandon the city, build walls around it, and then we start to see, okay, now let's start interacting with that city and start playing with that environment. And Sherry Priest has done a really good job of building up characters and telling parallel stories as we follow different characters across different chapters in the book before finally bringing them together. It's a really nice writing style. Really end up getting interested in these characters, even when they're not necessarily the most likable characters. And of telling an alternate story. Obviously, she's playing with history, playing with the dates and things like that. So, you know, this is alternate reality, you know, and so there's lots of differences there. But it's a really good book, and I was really happy to wrap up reading it this week. She's done a couple of other books since then. This one's been out for a couple of years old. It's a couple of years old now. But, yeah, Bone Shaker, definitely worth checking out if you're at all into cyberpunk or zombie stories.
Cool. And your plugs, how do we follow you digitally?
You can find me on Twitter at Cromley, and you can read a blog that hasn't been updated in almost a year at cromley.net.
You can follow me at Not In My Book on Twitter. That is the Caffeinated Comics Twitter feed. Like us on Facebook. A lot of things going on Facebook. And Steven's shop is 19 South LaGrange Road in LaGrange, Illinois. We will talk to you next week.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not In My Book production.
Take that!